ಜನ ವಲ್ಲಭ ಗಿರಿ ವಾರಧಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಾ ಮಾಧವ ಕುಂಜ ಬಿಹಾರಿ ಗೋಪಿ ಜನ ವಲ್ಲಭ ಗಿರಿ ವಾರಧಾರಿ ಯಶೋದನಂದನ ಬ್ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಶೋದನಂದನ ಬ್ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರ
ಕೃಷ್ಣ
Jaya Prabhupada Jaya Prabhupada Jaya Prabhupada Srila Prabhupada Bhagavatam ki jai Gopinandi. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 1, verse number 6. Etavan Sankhya Yoga Bhyam.
Etavan Sankhya Yoga Bhyam.
Swadharma Padinishthaya. Swadharma Padinishthaya. Janmalabha Padapumsam. Janmalabha Parapumsam Ante Narayana Smriti
Ante Narayana Smriti
Etavan Sankhya Yoga Bhyam Swadharma Parinishthaya Janmalabha Parapumsam Ante Narayana Smriti. Please repeat.
Etavan Sankhya Yoga Bhyam.
Etavan Sankhya Yoga Bhyam.
Swadharma Parinishthaya.
Swadharma Parinishthaya.
Janmalabha Parapumsam.
Janmalabha Parapumsam.
Ante Narayana Smriti.
Ante
Swadharma Parinishthaya. Ante Narayana Smriti. Etavan Sankhya Yoga Bhyam. Swadharma Parinishthaya. Ante Narayana Smriti. Etavan. All these. Sankhya.
Complete knowledge of matter and spirit.
Yoga Bhyam.
Knowledge of mystic power.
Swadharma.
Swadharma.
Particular occupational duty.
Particular occupational duty.
Parinishtaya.
Parinishtaya.
By full perception.
By full perception.
Janma.
Janma.
Birth. Labha. Gain. Varaha. The supreme. Pumsam.
Of a person.
Ante.
At the end.
Narayana. The personality of Godhead. Smriti. Remembrance. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The highest perfection of human life, achieved either by complete knowledge of matter and spirit, by practice of mystic powers, or by perfect discharge of occupational duty, is to remember the personality of Godhead at the end of life. Purport. Narayana is the transcendental personality of Godhead beyond the material creation. Everything that is created, sustained, and at the end annihilated is within the compass of the Mahatattva, material principle, and is known as the material world. The existence of Narayan, or the personality of Godhead, is not within the jurisdiction of this Mahatattva, and as such, the name, form, attributes, etc. of Narayan are beyond the jurisdiction of the material world. By the speculation of empiric philosophy, which discerns matter from spirit, or by cultivation of mystic powers, which ultimately helps the performer to reach any planet of the universe or beyond the universe, or by discharge of religious duties, one can achieve the highest perfection, provided one is able to reach a stage of Narayana Smriti, or constant remembrance of the personality of Godhead. This is possible only by the association of a pure devotee, who can give a finishing touch to the transcendental activities of all jnanis, yogis, or karmis in terms of prescribed duties defined in the scriptures. There are many historical instances of the achievement of spiritual perfection, such as that of the Sanakadi Rishi or the 9 celebrated Yogendras, who attained perfection only after being situated in the devotional service of the Lord. None of the devotees of the Lord ever deviated from the path of devotional service by taking to other methods as adopted by the jnanis or yogis. Everyone is anxious to achieve the highest perfection of this particular activity, and it is indicated herein that such perfection is Narayana Smriti, for which everyone must endeavor his best. In other words, life should be molded in such a manner that one is able to progressively remember the personality of Godhead in every step of life. Om Magyana Timidandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Karamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Gurun Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanditam Scha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Kaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpa Tarubhyascha Kipa Sindhu Bhevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Rama Translation once again, the highest perfection of human life achieved either by complete knowledge of matter and spirit, by practice of mystic power, or by perfect discharge of occupational duty, is to remember the personality of Godhead at the end of life. So, the last chapter of the first canto concludes with Maharaj Parikshit having finally met Sukadev Goswami. And now, in the second chapter, Sukadev Goswami is starting to speak. So basically what's happened is, in the earlier part of the first canto, I believe it's chapter 4, the sages were inquiring, or even earlier than that, they were inquiring from Sukadev Goswami. They wanted to know how the Bhagavatam came about. What is it that inspired Vyasadeva to speak the Bhagavatam? They also wanted to know, how is it that Parikshit Maharaj, being such a great king and giving shelter to so many citizens, why did he decide to renounce the kingdom? And how did he meet that great sage, Sukadev Goswami? How did that meeting take place? So these were the inquiries they wanted to know about Sukadev Goswami, Parikshit Maharaj, and Vyasadeva. So they were asking Sukadev Goswami, even though of course they themselves were fully knowledgeable about how Vyasadeva was inspired to speak the Bhagavatam. They were fully aware of the glories of Parikshit Maharaj and the glories of Sukadev Goswami, but individuals, personalities that were that elevated never tire from hearing about these glorious pastimes. And so ultimately that is where we want to get, ultimately. We're obviously, I think many of us, myself included, are very far from that stage where all we want to do is hear about these pastimes over and over again. I know that Lord Chaitanya, when he would get together in Jagannath Puri at the Tota Gopinath temple with Gadadhar Pandit, he would have Gadadhar Pandit repeat the pastimes of Lord Nrisingadeva like 100 times, just like repeat it again, say it again, say it again, and again and again and again. Like usually after one class we're ready for prasad, you know. But Mahaprabhu, that was the prasad. That was actually prasad. So obviously that's the Lord, and he relishes his own pastimes. And we are, you know, it's good, it's healthy to recognize where we are and where we need to be, but not to be depressed when we realize the gap that is, that the Grand Canyon of a gap that exists between where we are now and where we need to be. It's a Grand Canyon times 100 or 1,000. But it's okay not to be depressed. We've started on the process, and that's the most important thing, that we've started, we have entered you could say it's sort of like the Leela here to some degree. We've entered these teachings and we've started the practice. So there's lots of hope, and each step is important. We need to just stay focused on step one and step two and step three and step four and step five. And sometimes we become, I feel, overly focused. Like this verse is talking about Narayana Smriti. Hopefully people will misunderstand what I'm saying, that we don't want to overly become focused on going back to Godhead. So again, I said, don't misunderstand that. We want to focus on what we're doing now. So like, for example, beautiful garlands being made, right? If they're done nicely, yes, that is the step going back to Godhead. Like, I want to get in my car and go home. If I just think about going home, I might run the traffic light. I might run a stop sign. So I do need to stay focused on what I'm doing right now, right? Like, it's a very popular saying, right? Be in the present moment, right? We get sick and tired of hearing this. But really, it's a really important saying. We do need to be focused on the step right now, because if I stay focused on the step right now, that means my next step will also be very thoughtful and careful and will be well planted. And then I focus on the third step. So that means when I'm chanting, I try to focus only on the chanting. When I'm serving the deities, I just stay focused on the deities. Otherwise, if I'm just thinking of everything else, oh, I got to get back to God, and I'm so desperate, I just got to get out of the suffering material world, this is too much, then that means everything we're going to do is just not going to be very attentive. Whereas if we're attentively, it's like going through different stages of school. If you want to get to college, you got to pay attention in high school. You can't just be thinking about, oh my gosh, I can't wait to get my master's degree, I can't wait. It's good. Yes, that's your goal. You've set that goal. You know that that's your goal. But now let's focus on your class right now, your present homework assignment, your first midterm, then your final exam, and then graduation. You got to get out of there and then get to the next level. So I think that is very important, that in order for us to be able to get to those next levels, we do need to stay in the present moment. Just by coming here regularly, we've already established ourselves that our goal is going back to God, and we know why we're here. But in order to get to that stage, we need to be attentive, we need to be present, we need to be focused on what we're doing right now, which is true for not just devotional life, for your work, for your studies, your family life, whatever it is. One day at a time, one moment at a time, one small step at a time. And so, you know, this right here, I also want to just sort of set the context here, because when we look at these verses, so now Parikshit Maharaj has asked several important questions at the end of the last canto, and what's really nice, what's happening is, he's inquiring, it's explained in very sweet words from Sukadev Goswami. He's inquiring, what is the duty of somebody who's about to die, and what should that person not do? But he's doing it in a very sweet way, in a very humble way. And if you really think about it, he's able to be sweet and thoughtful to Sukadev Goswami, but he's about to die in 7 days. Now, if we found out we were going to die in 7 days, I mean, I think we would have kind of a hard time being really sweet to anyone. I mean, we'd be super humbled, for sure. We'd be shaking and trembling, and maybe that would cause some sweetness to come out. Because when you're scared and you're humbled, then you can be a little bit like, you know. But it explains that he was sweet, and he was even able to welcome the other sages that were coming, showing up for his passing, which is amazing. Like, his passing was so glorious, people from all over the universe came to be with him. And they said that we're going to be here until you leave. Can you imagine that? That the greatest of all personalities from the universe show up to your death. Like, you've lived such a glorious life, that you've lived a life, and he was a king, he lived such an exemplary life that not only did he please his citizens, he pleased the sages, because he did all the yajñas that were needed to satisfy the earth and everyone else. He did everything right. And therefore, people showed up to help him pass away from this world, to comfort him. Because from what I have heard, that last moment is a very, very scary moment in someone's life. It's a very scary moment. And not just to have support of family members who are crying for you, but also great sages who are creating. Each great sage brings with them all the holy places. So imagine thousands and tens of thousands of sages had gathered there, but they're all amazingly elevated beings. Just by seeing them, you get purified. So this was one of the most auspicious gatherings in the history of the universe, in the history of as far back as our history goes. And his consciousness was so good that he inquired with sweet words, what should one do who's about to die, and what should one not do? And so the context here is, now Sukadev Goswami speaks, and his message starts off quite strong, that his message is very geared towards renunciation. Like, for example, I'll read a couple of previous verses. So he talks about verse 3, the lifestyle of such an envious householder is passed at night either in sleeping or in sex indulgence, and in the daytime either in making money or maintaining family members. So he's talking about an envious householder, right? That's how they live. And persons devoid of atma tattva do not inquire into the problems of life, being too attached to family, to the fallible soldiers like the body, children, and wife. Although sufficiently experienced, they still do not see their inevitable destruction. So here, there's a bit of a, you know, somebody who reads this, and I know when I was first reading it, there's a very negative picture of householder life being painted, right? It's basically fallible soldiers like body, children, and wife, and, you know, envious householder, you know, sleeping or indulging in sex in daytime and making money in the day and sex at night. It's just like, oh my gosh, you know, I remember reading this verse, and the brahmacharis And we were like, we felt like, yeah, we're doing the right thing here. Like, yeah, we're not envious. We're not doing any of this. We're not wasting time making money. And we're not, you know, indulging in sex life at night. You know, spit at the thought, right? Well, you spit at the thought while you're thinking about it all the time, right? And so there's a very heavy negative picture that's kind of painted here. And I think a lot of people, when we first come into the movement, we take this at face value, right? Like, oh my God, this is a horrible thing to do. Making money, what's the point? And, oh, sex is horrible, and you know, we're envious, and we shouldn't do that, we should just give everything up. So when I thought about these verses, and I was thinking, well, you know, everything has a context. And in Scripture, I think a mistake that most people in most religious traditions will do is take things out of context from their Scripture, right? What that means is they'll take one verse out of context and isolate that verse and focus only on that verse and not focus on the things that were said before that verse to set the scene. So here's what I'm thinking here is that, well, first of all, who is speaking this? So that's also part of the context. Who is the one providing this message? It's someone who was born as a renunciate, right? Sukadeva Goswami came out of the womb. He didn't have to go through the different ashramas, the brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha. He came out, he was not even a sannyasi, he was a paramahamsa, boom. So much so he came out, didn't bother putting on clothes, he left home immediately, like gone. So much so that even when there were ladies, naked ladies bathing in the lake nearby, he didn't even notice them. He didn't make any difference between their bodies, the body of a tree, the body of a rock, the body of a man. He just kept walking. It was all just matter for him. So this is who's speaking, by the way. So we do have to know and think about who is giving the message as part of the context. It's someone who's renounced from life. And not just that. The second thing is, part of the context is, who is he speaking to? That's the other part we need to look at to understand the proper context of why he's giving these kinds of messages. And of course, he is describing that envious householder who's not thinking of Atmatatma, who's not thinking of Krishna, whose goal of life is not to go back to Godhead. But still, the context is important because a lot of us take this out of context. I know I did. I know a lot of people do. Most people do, actually. And the person he's speaking to is also a very important part of the context, is Parikshit Maharaj. He's no longer a king. He has walked away. He has probably done one of the hardest things a human being can do, to voluntarily walk away from power. Human beings have a very hard time walking away from anything. What to speak of a kingdom, the king of the planet, all respect, all prestige, respected by every single person pretty much. I mean, I don't think there's everyone that respects everyone, but for the most part, he did an amazing job. He walked away from that, his wealth, his fame, his wife, his kids, just walked away. And he's got 7 days to live. So he's on a mission. He's on a mission. He is rejecting the material world. He's on a mission to go back to Godhead. So here's someone who's rejected the material world, and the person speaking to him rejected the material world from the very beginning. So you've got two people who've rejected the material world coming together for a conversation. What do you think they're going to talk about? Loving family life? Probably not. Not in that moment. Right? Not in that moment. So we do need to understand that even when a spiritual master is talking to their disciple, they have a very good idea where this disciple is at. And they will instruct that disciple accordingly. I know when I was first joining the ashram, I was very inclined towards that life. And so my spiritual master encouraged me in that way. Right? Really encouraged me. Like, yeah, just go for it. It'll be great for however long you want to do it. No obligation. Do it for as long as you want to. Like, oh, great. Okay. I did it. And then when I was having doubts about that, I felt like, oh, okay, I wanted to change ashrams. He said, yeah, you'll be happy if you change ashrams. I think it's wonderful. Right? So at that point, he wasn't like, no, you got to keep doing this. So a spiritual master is expert at understanding what this disciple needs to hear and how that will help their progress in spiritual life. And who's more expert than Sukadev Goswami? And Prabhupada was also expert at this. Right? He was also expert at this. So, Sukadev Goswami, having that expertise, he could understand exactly where Parikshit Maharaj was at. Exactly where he was at. He was in the mood, he had already rejected everything. Everything material, his kingdom, his home, his comforts, his fame, his wealth, he had left it behind, and now he's going into the forest, he wants to renounce everything, and so he is speaking to him, encouraging him in that mode of renunciation. That whatever he's done, it's the right thing. That he's rejected it, it's the right thing. And of course, I don't know who all was there. I'm guessing most of the great sages that were there also were renunciates, possibly. I'm assuming, I don't know. There's no attendance sheet of who all was there and what their ashram status was. Married, unmarried, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we don't know what that was, but Sukadev Goswami is fully encouraging and Parikshit Maharaj that he's done the right thing right now for him. Because he was ready to do it and he did it voluntarily. He wasn't forced to do it. He wasn't told to do it. He, Parikshit Maharaj, left his kingdom voluntarily, understanding his heart, his mood of renunciation, and his desire to go back to Godhead. Sukadev Goswami starts bam, right away, right? Telling him that what you've done is right. And I think that, you know, for us, these are very, very important topics, I think, as a movement to sort of talk about, and so that we can have a healthy perspective on family life and just, you know, what it means and what it looks like for everyone. And I think that there have been a lot of challenges. I mean, even, for example, here, I'll look at chapter 2 I was looking at. Sukadev Goswami continues in this mood of renunciation in the next chapter. He's like, when there are ample earthly flats to lie on, what is the necessity of cots and beds? So like, when we first read this, almost every single one of us were like, yeah, what is the need of cots and bed when there's earthly flats to lie on? When one can use his own arms, what is the necessity of a pillow? You know, and as brahmacharis, we're feeling really proud that, yeah, we're doing this. You know, I'm just sleeping on like a thin mat here, right? And I'm just using my arms like a pillow is a bit of sense gratitude. I mean, I actually didn't use a pillow for like a decade or something. But you just get used to it. When one can use the palms of his hands, what is the need of variety of utensils? Right? It's like, what's the need? You've got it all. Yes, technically we do have it all. Technically we do have it all. You know, but of course, if you're running public programs or Western people are coming and you're putting your fist in your mouth full of prasadam and it's all dripping down everything, it doesn't look very, you know, sophisticated. It doesn't look very attractive. It doesn't make somebody want to explore this any further. Like, these guys are eating with their hands. You know, that's, anyway, so time, place, circumstance, which is something Prabhupada was expert at. And then the next one, when there is ample covering or the skins of trees, what is the necessity of clothing? So, and then are there no torn clothes lying on the common roads? Do the trees which exist for maintaining others no longer give alms and charity? So, very hardcore, like, what is one supposed to understand when you read this? We understand that initially when you read this, until we come to a little more mature level, we think that we're supposed to try to live as minimalistically, as simple, as austerely as possible. And that is just not realistic and possible for most people. It just isn't. It's great if you can get to that point on your own in a gradual, organic way where your mindset and whatever's happening in your life is pushing you in that direction, right? Parikshit Maharaj felt the inspiration to live in that way. 99.999% of the people will not get that inspiration. So most people will not get that inspiration. It has to come genuinely because of your devotion, because of things happening in your life. You're being called to go in that direction. And that is okay. But for most of us, when we read this, it creates a confusion in our mind. We start thinking that we have to live like this now. That we have to live as austerely as possible. That even if we're in Grihastha ashram, we should try and sleep on the floor. And there's so much confusion that gets created, and somehow it's never fully properly explained until you figure it out or you go through struggles. And you know, especially when it comes to like householder life, like I feel like a lot of times from my conversations and what I've heard, that you know, people try to be like brahmacharis and brahmacharinis while being married. And that may sound really awesome, like wow, but from reality, from what I've understood and from what I've heard from so many people, it just creates all kinds of a messy situation in householder life. Like, when you're living in that way, there need to be comfort, right? There has to be a certain amount of enjoyment and pleasure in terms of what you have. Like, even Kardama Muni, right? Well, I shouldn't say even Kardama Muni, but Kardama Muni, so austere, Devahuti, the just extreme levels of austerity. But then she asked him, she said, "No, I want to enjoy with you. I'm feeling passion towards you, but this environment, is this not suitable?" So he creates this unbelievable yogic palace. And it's explained, he was even amazed at what he ended up creating. He didn't realize it. It's like there were gardens and there were pleasure rooms and bedrooms and just like, boom, right? And then she looked at it and got a little more depressed because she was like thin and frail and like stained clothes and, you know, she was just serving him. So then he arranged for some, I don't know, maid servants to like give her a full-blown makeover. And it's explained that before she married him, she was so beautiful that the demigods would see her and they would like fall out of their airplanes. Like, she was just incredibly gorgeous. And so she achieved that same beauty again. And then they enjoyed for like, I don't know, 1,000 celestial years on that palace. Like, just enjoyed Grihastha life. Love between a husband and wife, a man and a woman. They just enjoyed. And so, ultimately, to have children and everything like that. But I think that when we read this, initially, I don't know how newer devotees are reading this, but we took extreme levels of understanding of Grihastha life. Like denying ourselves the basic pleasures that come in a union, in a family setting. The affection and love that comes between husband and wife. I think there has been a lot of artificial sort of detachment from one another because of how we've interpreted certain passages within scriptures. And a lot of that has even caused severe tensions in families, even separations in families. I've heard some really crazy cases of men and women within devotee circles not knowing how to interact with each other after getting married because so much of the scripture has been in their head, especially if they loved as brahmacharis. They just feel guilty about everything, right? Like, feel guilty about having some interaction with your wife. You just feel guilty. You can't talk about it. You can't talk about what's on your mind. So I think that, you know, and this is a conversation that is not encouraged, obviously, in our society so much. I think maybe it's starting to happen. But I think it is a conversation that should happen because it's going to show up, no doubt. It's going to show up. You know, everyone's at a different level. You can't, a Brahmana, a Kshatriya, a Vaishya, and a Shudra, they're all have different modes of nature impacting them. So, for example, a Shudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya's mode of passion is going to be much higher than that of a Brahmana, where a Brahmana could get married and feel very sense controlled, whereas the other three, totally not. They have their mode of passion, you know, bubbling up as every part of their body. They're not going to be that peaceful and calm and, you know, sexually tame, to so to speak. And the thing is that when we talk about this, a lot of guilt comes up. Oh, I shouldn't have these desires, these urges. Well, wait a second. How'd you come into this world, by the way? It's because of that urge. If that urge wasn't there, the planet would be ceased to exist, basically. Right? So the urge is everywhere. It's everywhere. The whole world is running, Prabhupada says, is running on sex desire. So there's no need to feel guilty when it's there. How we deal with it is something we do need to think about and to have conversations with the right people, with mentors, mature people, just understanding it's there, like so is hunger, so is a desire for sleep. All of these desires are there. It's been there from the time of Brahma and time immemorial. It's what creates the whole universe. Right? Even Brahma felt it. So it's there. Great sages like Vishwamitra Muni, amazing sages, right? Hearing the ankle bells of, who was it? Menaka. Just hearing the ankle bells after tens of thousands of years of meditation and austerity. He didn't touch her. He didn't look at her. Ding, ding, ding. That's all it took. Hari Bol. Right? That's all it took. That's how powerful the attraction is between male and female. And so, instead of feeling guilty about our who we are, the modes that are controlling us, the urges that we have, I think there just need to be healthy conversations about it. Because not talking about something, from my experience, only leads to more problems in the future. Because when we don't talk about it, but we still have expectations. And when we don't make those expectations clear, that's going to lead to a lot of discord and fighting and disagreements. So the main point is, for me, at least what I'm trying to make here, is that we shouldn't feel overly guilty. You know, I think a little bit of guilt can be healthy, no doubt. That helps us try to not make the same mistake again. You know, a little guilt, if you have no guilt, you're a scary person. Like you did something wrong and feel no guilt, like, well, that's not good. So a little guilt is healthy, but not so much that you're depressed about it. Acknowledging where we're at, we have to know, just because we started chanting or drink charanamrita, it doesn't mean our mode of passion and ignorance have gone away. Doesn't mean our sex desire has just flown out the window, or just because we shaved our head and put on saffron that it was just all washed away. Nothing gets washed away right away. Right? Like the example we've given is that we go into the shower, it takes a while to clean off the dirt. You gotta scrub, you gotta put on soap, you gotta put on shampoo, and everything gradually gets cleansed. So we are in the gradual process of cleansing. So it is a very big conversation, and my whole point here is just that acknowledging where we're at, healthy level of guilt is okay, but not so much that you're just beating yourself up about it. And maybe finding mentors or mature people to have this conversation with so that it doesn't lead to more problems and challenges and difficulties in the future, in our relationships. Right? So, you know, when I read this, I thought, you know, I wanted to address it because I know how as a brahmachari I used to see these verses and how in my mind I took a very hardcore stance on them. And then, you know, that I've changed ashrams now, I realize I have a very different perspective on it. I'm looking more at the context, like, well, who's speaking to whom? And what the setting is. Well, when you get two renunciates together, they're going to talk about renunciation. That's normal. And when you get grihasthas together, they're going to talk about grihastha life. You get two athletes together, they're going to talk about, you know, their favorite sport. So that's where the relish is when you talk about those things with other people of like-minded interest. So that's one thing That was sort of the main point that I wanted to discuss during reading this section. And of course, ultimately, if we are able to remain balanced and healthy in our Krishna consciousness, in terms of our, right, Prabhupada, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, I believe in the sixth chapter, I can't remember the exact verse, but it talks about not eating too much, not sleeping too much, right? And this talk about moderation in everything. There needs to be a healthy moderation in everything. Sense enjoyment is allowed. Sense gratification is allowed in the right, healthy manner, right? Me eating breakfast is sense gratification. So we have labeled sense gratification as something negative. But I am gratifying my tongue's desire to eat breakfast. If I don't, I'm going to have a hard time throughout the day. I am taking a shower. I'm gratifying my body. It's feeling good that I'm under a hot shower. It feels great. But I need to do that so that I can do my puja, I can worship, I can come to the temple, I can be clean. That is sense gratification, right? And when you've eaten too much, then you need to go to the bathroom. That's also gratifying your senses, feeling some relief after that. Sleeping is also gratifying our senses. Right? All of this are bodily needs. Eating, sleeping, mating. These are, label them as really bad, but they're also just, they just need to be done in moderation in a healthy way. And what is moderation for one is not moderation for another. Right? Bhima ate much more than his other brothers did. He's not a sense gratifier. He's a pure devotee, by the way. He's not a sense gratifier. He could eat an entire cart of food. Like everything that's going to be made on Gaur Purnima here, he could down it no problem. And are we all going to be like fault-finding with him? Like, hey, he's a sense gratifier? No, he just has a different capacity. He has a different digestion. He can digest 10,000 gulab jamuns without any problem. Might be an appetizer for him. Right? So similarly, how much sleep someone needs, you can't compare that to someone else. Because someone else may need 8 or 9 hours to be normal in the morning. Some may be good at 5.5. You can't compare. Someone's sexual desire may be different too. As soon as we mention that, we get so uncomfortable. Like, oh, that everyone has to be fully renounced in. But wait a second. If everyone's intelligence is different, everyone's creativity is different, everyone's ability to perform in academia is different, everyone's ability to perform athleticism is different, everyone has a different musical ability, everyone has a different diet, everyone has a different requirement for sleep, then naturally the modes are also suggesting that everyone's going to have a different desire, level of desire for sexual life. And I'm not suggesting promiscuity here. I'm not just suggesting random, right, illicit kind of a thing. I'm just saying everyone is differently built. And we need to recognize how we're built and understand and figure out how we need to progress, what we need to do, how we need to live, what kind of guidance and support we need to live a healthy, balanced life. Because if we don't live a healthy, balanced life, you know what won't be possible? What's described here as Narayana Smriti. Remembering Lord Narayan is not going to be possible if we're suppressing our nature of eating, sleeping, mating, defending. If we're artificially suppressing it, like Arjuna wanted to artificially suppress his nature by going into the forest. And Krishna vehemently said, ain't no way you're going to survive that. You go out there, you'll be getting into fights with who knows who. Because your Kshatriya nature is going to pop out somewhere. You're going to start defending the villages. You're going to start doing something out there. And then you'll be caught by Duryodhana. They'll start chasing you again. You cannot suppress yourself. But at the same time, we don't act sinfully and in a wild and crazy way. So again, spiritual life is not that simple. It is complicated when we figure out how to live day to day, moment to moment, how to include Krishna consciousness in everything we do in a balanced way. That is not an easy thing, actually. I know we say Krishna consciousness is simple for the simple, complicated for the complicated. I think it's kind of a little bit challenging for everyone. it does require a lot of thought, humility, honesty, to understand where we're at, where we need to be, and what are the steps that I need to take to get there. And my steps will be different from every other person in this room. The steps I'm going to take to get to Narayana Smriti are going to be different from the steps you're going to take, and from the steps that your spouse is going to take, from the steps your kids are going to take, from the steps your brothers are going to take, your God brothers and sisters. Everyone's going to be on their own unique journey. We're all going toward the same goal, Narayana Smriti, Krishna Smriti. We're trying to get there. But just because we can move at a certain speed doesn't mean others can. And we need to let others move at their own speed. So these were some of my thoughts on today's verse. And I was going to try and say a few words about Madhavendra Puri, but there's only 5 minutes left. So, you know what? I'll go ahead and say something anyways. All right, so I'm just going to repeat what I heard from a lecture from my spiritual master last night. So, it's very brief that when Lord Chaitanya took sannyas, he went to Shantipur to the house of Advaita Acharya. And then from there, he decided to go to Jagannath Puri so that his mother could continue to get news of him. And on the way, they stopped at Ramuna, this place called Ramuna. And there was a Gopinath deity there. And Lord Chaitanya was very eager to try the sweet rice that they offered to that deity, the famous sweet rice. So while they were waiting, he decided to tell his 4 associates, I can't remember who they were, I think Nityananda Prabhu, I can't remember the 4 associates he was with, but he decided to recite to them the pastimes of Madhavendra Puri, how Madhavendra Puri had traveled to Vrindavan, and then he had come to Govardhan Hill. And when he saw the Govardhan Hill, he went into complete ecstasy. He began crying, because he saw that as non-different from Krishna. And it's explained that before Madhavendra Puri, in our parampara, the understanding of conjugal loving affairs of Radha and Krishna wasn't really present. He's the one who actually introduced the conjugal loving affairs of Radha and Krishna. And so when he was at Ramuna, Madhavendra Puri, when he was in Vrindavan at Govardhan, he was sitting there and he was fasting. And at Govindakund, so this is where Lord Indra had actually tried to, after he trying to destroy Vrindavan, he finally realized who Krishna was and he begged forgiveness. And he actually did an abhishek of Krishna. So this is where Madhavendra Puri was sitting and just fasting. And then one boy came up to him and said, here's a pot of milk. And then Madhavendra Puri said, well, how did you know that I was here and how I was fasting? He's saying, well, in our village, nobody fasts. And you can easily get enough prasad just by begging from the villagers. Nobody fasts in our village. And the ladies who come here to bathe told me that you were here, and they asked me to bring you this pot of milk. So please drink it. I'll come back for the pot later. Of course, he drank it. The little boy never came back. And then at night, Madhavendra Puri went to sleep under that tree. And at night, he had this dream where the same boy came. And in his dream, the boy took him by the hand, and he says, he took him to this area, a very bushy area. And he said that, I am buried here. Let's see here. He said that I reside in this bush and I've been suffering from the heat, cold, and wind. Please have the people come and take me out of here and have them build me a temple on top of the hill and situate me there. So Madhavendra Puri said, okay, well, he woke up. And then this boy explained that when the Mohammedans attacked, the pujari hid me here and he ran away. So please take me out of here. So Madhavendra Puri in the morning got all the villagers together. They came with their choppers and machetes and cleared out the area, and they found this beautiful deity, Gopal. And then they basically built a temple on top of the Govardhan Hill and placed him there. And they brought 900 pots of water. And all the villagers brought all kinds of food. It's explained that they brought all the food that they had, actually. Like, they just gave everything to Krishna. Like, all the food, all the jewelry, they just, like, literally emptied out their houses and gave it to Krishna. And then the neighboring villages found out, and they brought everything. So a massive, massive festival took place, all inspired by Madhavendra Puri. And of course, you know, we don't climb Govardhan Hill, right? We follow Lord Chaitanya's example, but he's the one who introduced the whole, the loving conjugal exchanges between Radha and Krishna in our sampradaya. So, anyways, and then Madhavendra Puri actually could see when everything was offered to the Lord. He could actually see Gopal eating everything, but at the same time, Gopal was so merciful, he left everything as Mahaprasad. And then Madhavendra Puri wanted to serve, distribute the prasadam to everyone who had come. So that was a very short story of Madhavendra Puri and celebrating the excavation of Gopalji, which is also something our Goswamis did. They also excavated the lost deity, so they were kind of following in his footsteps. So anyways, I'll conclude here. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Madhavendra Puri ki, Tagore Premanandi. I'll take a question or two if there are any questions. Otherwise, we can conclude.
Haribo. One time, there was this new devotee who asked me an advice according to bathing with cold water. To put you in the context, we are in Canada. The cold water is liquid ice. So she said, should we bathe in the morning with cold water because the brahmachari are getting so much bad backs, they cannot function anymore. So my reflex was, well, if it's going to stop you from doing your service, this is false, you know, renunciation. Was my advice correct?
Yeah, not just for service. If it's affecting their health in any way, right, that's primary. First thing is, if it's affecting their health in a negative way, then we have to change things, because ultimately, yes, that health is needed to serve the deities, right? To serve the devotees. And ultimately, see, health comes first, then our sadhana, and then our seva. And then preaching. Because without health, how much can we focus on sadhana? And without sadhana, what's our consciousness in our service? And then without that service, how can we serve? So yes, absolutely, that was the right advice to give.
So this could be like a good example of instruction, but put in the right context.
Exactly, yes. And you know, even if someone just has a very hard time with cold water bath, that's just for this, right? There's like teeth gritting and just can't stand it. Okay, just don't do it. Maybe they don't get sick by it. Like, I can handle it, but I don't like it. I won't get sick because of it, but I don't like it. So I'm like, I'm not going to torture myself every day in the name of devotional service. Like, it's supposed to be joyfully performed. Let me not get in an irritable mood right off the bat, you know? Because everyone's body type is different also. Not everyone is built the same. Some can do something, some can't do something. We have to take all of that into consideration for the good of that individual. And then they'll appreciate that we thought of their good. And that'll naturally inspire them to serve better. So yes, Liz, thank you.
You have time?
Okay, sure.
Okay, we all know in Grihastha life that we're not going to be at the same level of devotional. I don't like to use the word level. It's not levels. It's different way that we want to take this path of Krishna consciousness according to so many facts. So for sure, somehow or another, in the couple will have to put water in his wine to adjust to the situations. Sometimes it can have a real impact on your spiritual life, how to take this.
Yeah, so I also agree with your point not to use levels, because everyone can achieve the same level. You know, brahmacharis, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyasi, it all depends on consciousness, literally, right? So I think that this is obviously a very big, broad question, and an answer to this would be dependent on the specific individual situation. So it's hard to give a broad answer, but I think it does require maturity and proper guidance to decide. I think the key thing is, how do you keep the family together? I think that is number one, right? If at all possible. If at all possible. In certain situations, it may not be possible. But as much as possible, because once that's not there, it affects the kids, it affects your own physical, mental and emotional health, it messes up everything. And then how are you going to really serve when the stuff at home is not falling into place? So I think that's number one, that has to be really paid attention to. And again, it's not a simple answer, because each situation is incredibly complicated. Each family unit is very complicated, right? How each one was raised, what their culture is, what their background is, it's just so complex. So, but I would say that should be a priority.
Thank you very much. I like your class a lot.
Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki.